All right, hello and welcome back to episode 3 here of Shardboard of the Rings. It's our very, very sporadic podcast where we look at some of the Brandon Sanderson writings and books out there. Tonight, we are going to be diving into Yumi and the Nightmare Painter, which was the third secret project that he released back in 2023. We are a few months behind where this book actually released, but excited to get to sit down and talk again with the same two folks that have been here with me on all these episodes. I am Eric, a.k.a. Shellen. And with me tonight, I have, from COTR, we've got Mark, the secondhand Took. How are you doing tonight, Mark?
I'm doing pretty good. I can't believe it's only our third episode. I feel like we've done more, but oh well.
Right, I know. But it's funny, we did two kind of like pretty close to one another, and then we talked about doing Yumi and just scheduling and everything went crazy. So, I mean, we're a little late to this one, but should be fun to get to talk about it, I think. And then also tonight, we've got from the rival podcast here from Card Talk, we've got Matt Cat Attack 22. How are you doing tonight, Matt?
Pretty good.
I mean, are we really rival podcast? I feel like probably not, but we joked about it before, Aaron. I like it that way.
I believe now, Chad and Dave have called it sister podcasts before, okay. But you know,
that's probably more correct. Truly. how are you doing tonight, Matt?
I'm doing all right.
Good, good. So, yeah, like I said, we're gonna talk a lot of Yumi and the Nightmare Painter tonight. But as I joked before recording here, I do a bad job of warning about spoilers here. So, again, we are talking, you know, the fantasy books, novels of the Cosmere by Brandon Sanderson. So tonight, that is the main book we're going to be talking about, but we are going to have spoilers for basically everything that he's ever written, potentially even including some like sample chapters that he's put out for unreleased works that are coming out later this year. So if you haven't read all of him, this is probably not a great episode for you to listen to, which means we understand that the listener base for this is not super huge, but be warned that, yeah, there's a lot of spoiler talk happening, not just for this book, but maybe for some others as we dive into some things. So before we get into this, just because it has been so long, what have you guys been up to since we got last recorded? I know we were all kind of really excited to be doing these secret project read-alongs and that sort of thing, and we talked about them as they came out and we read them, but you know, it's been many moons since those books have come out. What else have you guys been reading or playing or doing since we last got together?
I thought about this a little bit because I've actually read quite a bit since Yumi came out. Mm-hmm. Basically, we had Defiant, which is the last of Brandon Sanderson's young adult sci-fi series, the Skyward series, come out.
Okay.
So I read that. I did not reread the entire series before that. I went off my memory on that one. Maybe that was a mistake. It came to a nice, satisfying conclusion, so that was good.
It's always good when a series wraps up well. I have not read any of his non-Cosmere series, but someday I probably will get to it.
Yeah, it's a pretty solid entry. It's probably one that I might try to get my daughter to read when she's old enough. Mm-hmm. She's a bit young for it right now. Good, sure. Strong female protagonist. And then because of that coming out and the last Stormblood Archive, I signed up for an Audible deal, and they kindly offered me access to the two later books and a superhero series I read about 8 years ago called Wearing the Cape. And so I reread like that entire series, re-listening to the audiobooks, going ones I keep reading. There's like 9 books of that with some small novellas in between. It's one of those where it's very good for like Kindle Unlimited. Granted, I started before it was Kindle Unlimited, but they were cheap, not super long. But it was a nice leaning into the superhero tropes, lots of time travel, altered dimension type stuff, but a little bit more thought into the world building of how do superhero teams fit into a legal framework. But it's still very humorous bent. It's one of those that the world building made a lot more sense to me 8 years ago. Looking back on it, reading it again now, I'm like, yeah, I don't buy the politics of this world very much, especially after the last the last administration. So
sure.
Yeah, it just hasn't aged super well in that regard, but a lot of the other stuff, at least the thought process put into it, works pretty well. But it shows kind of its quality in the terms of the writing, how many books there are, how quickly they were written. It's cool. Definitely not Brandon Sanderson level.
Oh, but yeah, nice to have a big long series like that you can kind of immerse yourself into for a while.
Yes. And then other than that, a lot of comic book readings. And a few series that I get on a regular basis, and then been catching up on Adam Warlock stuff that I've had collection. One of my birthday gifts not too long ago was an omnibus with all his early appearances. So that's some hefty reading there.
The only reason I know him is because he's the like Council of the Wise hero in the Marvel Champions card game, where like his entire deck is singletons. So I hated it because it's just such a pain to build those. So that's literally all I know about him. But that's great.
One of my favorites in that. But it's also he's like a combination of Council of the Wise, Bond of Friendship. So you have to mix all four aspects and keep them in equal partitions. Right. And yeah, I think he's one of the most interesting ones to deck build for, even though I haven't really tried to build my own deck with him. Did the Wild Tutor one that's incredibly popular in Marvel CBD.
Mm-hmm.
And it just works so well. It's pretty fun to play. I played it through the whole Thanos, Mad Titan Shadow.
Gotcha. Well, I'm sure you're much better at that game than I am. Probably me not net decking and trying to do it myself is the primary cause for my struggles.
I don't know. Marvel Champions is definitely my secondary LCG to Lord of the Rings. I pretty much net deck on those and play through the campaigns like once and then go back to Lord of the Rings or my other board games for a while. I'm still playing Mutant Genesis, and Next Evolution has been out for a while, and Age of Apocalypse is almost out.
Right, yeah. They're pumping those out. Perfect. Well, how about you, Mark? What have you been up to?
So there is one series that I did finish a reread on that I will wait because I think you have a point here in the show notes that I'll bring it back up. But just going through a couple of reading, I also, Matt, I did read Defiant as well. I hadn't read the Skyward Flight novellas, so I also was pushing through those, which I kind of struggled with a little bit, but the very last one I thought was really good. And just to echo what you said, I do think overall it is a very good like YA series, and some of the topics they cover, even though it is a YA book, feel very, I don't want to use the word nuanced, but I just like what they cover in it, as well as having like an independent, strong, independent like female protagonist. Other things that I read was I finally got to read Nausicaa of the Valley of the Wind, like the manga that I guess it was originally a manga, but the Studio Ghibli movie that came out like in the 80s. I've always wanted to read the whole thing, so that was fascinating. And then another random book, if I could throw like a recommendation, is I read a book called A Prayer for the Crown Shy by Becky Chambers, which is a really short story set in a sci-fi world where we've kind of solved everything, like humans are happy and there's no violence, and it's just about like two characters trying to like find their place in the world. Very, very good. And then outside of reading, I played an unhealthy amount of Elden Ring for probably like 4 months straight. So
okay.
And that took up a lot of my life, and played a lot of Elden Ring. So
nice. It's fun. I will maybe check that out, because what I was just going to say on my book front here is I've really tried to branch out my reading recently because I think as we talked maybe on our first time together, like I've read a ton of fantasy. And for a while that was kind of all I read. So I've been trying to spread my wings a little bit into things that I haven't heard of before. So I've been soliciting recommendations from a lot of people. So not too different, but I've read a couple of the Andy Weir, I don't know how to pronounce his last name, but The Martian, and then Project Hail Mary. I read those two recently, which were both pretty good, I thought. And then Dan from the Hall of Bajorn, he recommended a book to me recently that was called I Dreamed of Empires, which is like a kind of like a historical fiction, alternate history sort of thing about like the fall of like the ancient Aztec capital when the conquistadors were showing up, but like told kind of like alternate history-ish style that I'm like halfway through and really enjoying at the moment. Again, just very different from a lot of what I've read previously. So that's kind of what I've been doing. And then the big one for me, though, was that I have been reading Fellowship of the Ring. I just finished Fellowship of the Ring with my son. So I've been reading that out loud to him. So we just wrapped up that one after about a month and a half and are about, and we just met Treebeard in the Two Towers. So that's my my other big, exciting reading that's going on now is getting to share that with him. So those are my primary books at the moment.
I do have to ask, is your Treebeard voice influenced by the movies or do you have your own spin? How do you handle Treebeard?
My Treebeard voice is a little bit inspired by the movies, not quite as slow because he does talk a fair bit more in the book. I can't slow it down that much. It's pretty similar to my Gandalf voice, which is just like a little bit deeper than my normal reading voice. I don't give too much like extra accent or inflection, but I do really try to make the bar, like you know, get those words in there. So it's influenced, but not identical.
Very cool.
Perfect. So yeah, sounds like we've all been pretty busy with some Sanderson and some not stuff, which is always exciting. So before we get into Yumi, since we talked some of other Sanderson works here, just get a little bit of a pulse on all of us here for the couple things that are coming out here in 2024, maybe early 2025. The big one, obviously, is going to be Wind and Truth. So since we talked last, we got a title reveal for Stormlight 5. We have a release date, I think December 7th, coming up soon. So we're closing in. We're only like, 8 months away or so from Stormlight 5, the final book in this first half of that series. Are either of you doing a reread of Stormlight Archive, either a full reread or like a partial reread this year in the lead up to that?
So that was sort of like the other series I was alluding to. I think if, I guess, refer, you know, in the chat that we've had, I think I'm scrolling through Goodreads while I'm vamping. I started a reread back in, looks like the end of 2022. And because I, in my head, I'm like, I'm going to reread and take my time and try to like fill the months until Stormlight 5 comes out. And then I think once I broke through Way of Kings again, which I still love the book, but that was kind of like, okay, I'm ready to read like more 1,000-page books. I started blowing through them and finished Rhythm of War, it looks like, November of last year. So unfortunately, I did not space it out as much as I would have liked to have. But that's a good thing. That means they're still really enjoyable. And I think for some of these, it's now like my third, maybe Way of Kings is my fourth, I can't remember. But like these, I think it's this series and Lord of the Rings are the only two I've reread to this extent. Okay. So, but yeah, I'm really excited for, I forgot it was December and I thought it was November for Stormlight 5 until you said that. And that feels like an extra eternity.
It does, I know. How about you, Matt?
I'm planning to, and actually now I started thinking about it, I'm like, I might actually end up skipping Way of Kings and Words of Radiance just because I have reread those so many times.
Sure.
Especially Way of Kings, because I'm sure I've reread that at least 13, if not 14, 15 times.
Yeah, you know what's going on.
Yeah, I know it pretty well. And then last the last time we read about it, it was starting to wear on me that I knew it so well. So I think I might have to skip those two just because I've reread them every time the other books have come out. As long as also with long car trips, sometimes just been like, yeah, I could use with some Brandon Sanderson right now to kill 6 hours.
Right.
So, and actually, I think I might spend a little more time rereading the novellas between. I don't think I've read them more than once, maybe twice, some of those. So, especially the last one,
Dawnchard, yeah.
Right with Rhythm of War. Those I could use a good refresher on.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I'm kind of an in-between you two there, where I don't know for certain, but I feel like I've probably reread every book right before the next one was released. So I know for sure I've only read Rhythm of War the one time. And I think I've read Oathbringer twice and you know, Words of Radiance three times now, and et cetera. I will probably do a full reread at this point. I haven't started yet, but I'll probably do it. But I definitely need to at the very least do Oathbringer and Rhythm of War again, just because, yeah, I haven't read Rhythm of War since I devoured it over the span of like 3 or 4 days or whatever it was, right when it got released. Mm-hmm. So that was too fast of a read. There are definitely things that I forgot about, I'm sure. And then similar with Dawnchard, I think I only read it the one time right when it released as well. So I need to, just to catch up on those things. Have you guys read the any of the sample chapters or preview chapters, prologue, anything like that that has been released for it?
I definitely read the interludes that came out for Stormlight 5. I'm a little fuzzier on some of the other sample chapters and stuff, if I've read them or not. I probably have and may have just forgotten, because I intentionally try to forget a lot of the stuff leading up to hype up, because it's like, it'll get here when it gets here. Don't need to worry about it.
Right.
Manage my expectations a bit.
Yeah, I think I read the interlude that came out, quote unquote, recently. And I don't remember like how many chapter, if there's more than how many previews are out there. I remember one with Seth. And
yeah, he's got a couple. Yeah, I think Kaladin has 2 point of view chapters that are kind of just like him getting ready to leave. Like, we knew he was going to leave, and it's just him getting ready. And then we've got like 2 or 3 flashback chapters with Seth there.
Yeah, assuming he does what he did with Rhythm of War, I'll probably start reading the sample chapters when it's at the like 15-week mark, where like every week was a new sample chapter. Or I can't remember the cadence, but the publishing company was releasing like pre chapters. And definitely read the prologue, because wasn't that part of the Kickstarter?
It was.
Had, like, a final video, and he was like, by the way, here's the prologue.
Yes, and the prologue is big news, because it doesn't confirm, but really gave a lot of credence to the big Shallan theory that's out there. So I'm excited for that. Is kind of the
the prologue that came out was the Gavilar POV, right?
His POV, yeah.
Yeah. Yep, I did read that one. It's been a long time.
Yeah, because I mean, that would have been like last January or February or whenever the secret, or maybe before that. Whenever the secret project Kickstarter happened. So
all I remember is Brandon filming something where he's like looking out over cliffs. I think he's like celebrating like the success of the Kickstarter. And then it was like, click the link in the description to watch like the prologue. And it was like an hour long video that he secretly uploaded.
Yep. Perfect. Speaking of secrets and uploading and all that sort of stuff, the other big one there would be the Isles of Emberdark, the Secret Project 5. So that's the other kind of fun bit of news here. We got another Sanderson secret project. This one is a sort of sequel, but also kind of eats it and rewrites a little bit of Sixth of Dusk into the book there, which should be fun. He says it's space age era, like set way in the future, a lot of Cosmere connectivity. And he's not joking. We've got Yolan and Frost mentioned in the sample chapters there and stuff. So that one should be fun for those of us that are, you know, a bit more Cosmere aware and like to get into the weeds of some of those things, to get a little bit more of that Dragonsteel era characters and planets mixed in, which should be fun.
Those I started reading the first one of those, but I didn't finish it yet. So. I'm not super up on it, but also at the same time, it's it's one of those where I remember reading Six of Dusk and be like, it's got some interesting implications. And there was, I think there was another short story set in the Sixth of Dusk world, in one of the other anthologies. It's like, This definitely sounds like great stuff that will be in Mistborn Era 3, or I guess now Mistborn Era 4. And yeah. So, you know, it's kind of like, yeah, we'll get to there eventually. So it's hard to feel excited about it, because it's like, okay, yeah, we'll get this other little tidbit, but we're still a long ways away from that being like the current era.
Definitely. Yeah. Yeah. I'm sure we'll talk more about that when we do our next episode where we talk Sunlit, because I think he said that this book takes place not too long after Sunlit Man took place. So I think maybe some similar feelings that I had with that one will probably take place here as well.
That was my real big hope when he announced Secret Project 5. Could we be getting another Sunlit Man story? And I was like, probably not, but man, would that be nice.
Yeah. How about you, Mark? How are you feeling about SP5?
Yeah, I really like what we've seen of, what we've seen of dragons so far. So I'm really looking forward to that being brought to the center stage a little bit. So that's really, and it seems like Brandon's really excited about Dragonsteel and what that is. So I'm curious to see what's going to happen when some of the shackles are taken off a little bit for him, and he gets to talk about that stuff. And then I enjoy the Six of the Dusk setting and like the concept of the story. But I do understand like that some people weren't a fan of the short story. So I am looking forward to it. It's rare that we get to have like a remake or a remastered edition of like a story. And if this like improves it, I think that would be interesting. Cause I think he said that the original short story was going to be the interludes, if I'm not mistaken. Yep. So, yeah, I'm really interested for sure.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. Getting a dragon as a POV main character who was also one of Hoid's apprentices is that's a good sell right there in and of itself for me, for sure. All right. So yeah, I think the other big piece is like when we first we were chatting in group text about the state of the Sanderson article that he released, and you know, after Stormlight comes out, there was going to be a really, really long gap before we got another Cosmere book. So I think getting another Secret Project, even if it's only a few months after Stormlight, will be nice. Just, the, you know, because it was like going to be like 2027 or something like that. Maybe 2028 before the first Mistborn book comes out. So, right. Yeah. So that's just a long time to go between Stormlight and Mistborn. So even one more little novel is nice to bridge us over that gap. Okay, so let's get into Yumi here, since we've been talking this. So I think just to kick it off here, what are our overall thoughts on this one? Like, where do we think it ranks, you know, amongst the other Secret Projects or within the rest of the Cosmere? Just kind of first impressions of the book. Did we like it, and maybe why or why not? Kind of briefly. I'll start with. Let's go, Matt. Why don't you hit us off with your thoughts on this one first?
So overall, I didn't hate it, but it's pretty low for me in terms of the overall Cosmere stories.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Why is that?
I think a lot of it has to do with I saw the influences on this one way too much.
Okay.
Like, a whole time I kept being like, oh, this is this anime trope. Oh, this is from this. And then the big turn happened. I was like, oh, he's doing this. Okay. And it just kind of took the wind out of the story for me a lot. So... Yeah, it's probably down there for me. I might even be below like some of his earlier stuff, like Warbreaker and Elantris, that I enjoy those, even though I realize they're not the strongest stories.
Yeah, they've got some pacing issues for sure, and some prose issues compared to some of his later stuff.
And that's the other thing as I tried to reread Yumi, is the pacing on this one is, I think, abysmal for Brandon.
Yeah.
I got to the halfway point in the audiobook, and I was like, we're just now at the halfway point, and now things are starting to move along in the plot. It's like, I know with this long storm Tori Philly, like, the pacing can be slow. There's a lot to digest and build on and everything else. And I even see a shortcut in making it easier for the reader to not have to explain as much with the magic system in Painter's World. But it's like, why is it, like, why did it take half the book to get here to where it feels like the plot is finally starting to move forward?
Yeah. That's fair. So I'm excited for this discussion because we have some pretty differing opinions here. So I'm probably kind of a more middle of the road thing to spoil where I'm at, but we'll get to me in a minute. So Mark, what are your thoughts on this book?
Yeah, I think you hinted at it pretty clearly. Yeah, so I really like this book. Now, I will say, Matt, like while you were talking, I haven't reread this book, and this is very much like a mystery novel in some respects, because we're trying to figure out like what's happening to Yumi and Painter. And I, pacing issues aside too, like I would be curious, these books always kind of are at risk at a reread, cause you kind of know what's happening, because it all kind of like is driven by this what if or what's happening. But ignoring that, when I read it, it was my favorite of the Secret Projects at the time, and after reading Sunlit, I think it still stays up there. And I haven't read the Secret Project 2, the handbook one, but I think I liked it for basically the exact same reasons that you didn't like it, Matt, which I think are kind of like, it's helpful, I think, because then like someone could be like, oh, if I'm really tired of anime tropes, or I love anime tropes, or I don't know if I want to read an anime trope with Brandon Sanderson, then I think it kind of helps you know what you're getting into. What I remember, though, I enjoyed the romance of it. I enjoyed the anime tropes with some very major exceptions. Maybe we'll get into it later, but the one big one was just like how the female characters were described or represented, which is just something that I think I said to you. I looked back through the chat, and I said, sometimes it felt like when I would be watching anime and I wouldn't want someone to come into the room because I would feel embarrassed and not know how to, like, you know, like, oh, no, I'm here for the story, truly. Like, please, I'm not the one who drew these characters. And there were some moments like that. But I think ultimately I do enjoy how it handled what defines art and, like, what makes art special. And I do marketing as a day job, and have become very opinionated on AI art and whatnot. Yeah. So, and I know Brandon even said he did not plan for this because he wrote this before AI took off, but I very much was in tune with what he was saying and just really liked how he, I mean, heck, he made rock stacking like seem very fascinating and powerful and in a book form. Like, I'm sure it actually is fascinating in real life, but like he made it really exciting on paper. So yeah,
I think the AI art and like what defines art piece was pretty interesting, especially like you said, with the knowledge that like he wrote this before like all these Midjourney and sorts of things had really come super far into the public eye, and that he wasn't even necessarily like super influenced by it, that because it was very topical by the time the book released. And yeah, I think a lot of folks obviously that are plugged into the art world and that sort of thing are very much going to be in agreement with Brandon's take on what defines art, right? That he kind of set up in this book, which I think was kind of a fun thing to do there. And you could tell that it was important to him as well, as, you know, he considers himself an artist for sure with his writing and everything. So I thought that was kind of an interesting, like, added bonus to the book there, to provide some actual timely social commentary as well, which isn't always the case when a book is released, right?
For sure, for sure. I also felt like, if I'm not mistaken, because he said this was the one that was a gift to his wife, right?
Correct. This and Tress both were, but yeah.
Okay, so this one I also kind of read like, you know, it's probably Brandon grappling with himself too, since he is like known for being a very like timely author you know, some authors will spend 10 years writing the next book, ignoring the major ones that I'm alluding to, but like sometimes for good reason, because like, you know, if it is worth 10 years, like who are we to define that?
Right.
And then where you have Painter being like, well, if I just like paint this bamboo and it gets the job done, you know, and everyone's happy, who cares? So I really felt like, oh, is this like Brandon like struggling with himself? Like, oh yeah, if I just put out a novel like every year and everyone's happy, like technically we're all good, right? And I thought that was interesting as well, just knowing his cadence as he puts out books. Like, is this something that he grapples with?
Yeah. Yeah, I like that. So, yeah, as I kind of alluded to, I think I'm kind of more middle of the road here. I would say it's my least favorite of the three Cosmere Secret projects, but that has more to do with Tress and Sunlit than it does to do with this book, I think, for me. And I probably don't have it below Warbreaker and Elantris, but it's in like the lower quartile probably of Cosmere things for me, but it's still good. I still quite enjoyed it. And I think for me, the big difference between myself and the two of you is that I don't do anime at all. So none of these tropes, like, I'm going to be a little familiar with some of it just because they kind of are just so common and over the top. But like, I remember reading some of the like 17th Shard things, and maybe Your Name was one of the anime that they said this really draws from or something like that, I believe. Like, I've never heard of that before. Like, I've never heard of any of these things that people are saying that this really drew from on that side of it. So there was nothing for me to kind of tether myself to for either liking or disliking the familiarity, except for the big one, which he talked about in the postscript there, which I think all of us have talked about and have played, would be Final Fantasy X, right? Where... You know, it's been, I haven't played this since probably it came out, so I don't want to screw this up. Did one of you, have you played it more recently or more familiar with the FF10 story to kind of give the very quick synopsis of all of the similarities between, like, our Titus and Yumi and all these sort of people, Father Machine and Sin and all that stuff?
I mean, yeah, so I replayed, or I finished, because I never finished it when I was a teenager, so I actually went back and finished Final Fantasy X probably 3 or 4 years ago.
Okay.
And yeah, I mean, it's, I guess, like, really big, quick similarities. One, it's like a bleak world, and people who find joy in the bleakness, and kind of like this ever-present threat. So you have, like, this monster Sin in Final Fantasy X versus the Shroud, I would say, in Yumi. And then just, I guess the fact by virtue of Final Fantasy X being influenced by Southeast Asian, mythology, you know, there's also just like a similarity in tone because our fantasy with Sanderson has been different, up until now, or has been more traditional up until now in a way. The last main one just being that the two lovers are coming from different worlds with quotes in there, and the reveal that one of the partners is not a traditional living human being is probably the best way I could describe it. And they just reverse the genders in this one.
Right. Yeah, exactly. So yeah, especially the big reveal there with like, Yumi and Titus kind of having pretty similar-ish backstories and what they're doing.
And like a tale of like a love that won't be, because like it's not meant to last because one physically like can't stay. So that's, I mean, because I know we're going to talk about that at one point, I'm sure, as it relates to this book. So that's like another element that they share, is that they're clearly meant to be, but one of them is not supposed to be here. So it's supposed to be short lived.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's just get into that now since you brought it up. I will say that I can understand where Sanderson's coming from, because I hate him talking about it. I don't remember if he talked about it in a quote afterward or if he talked about it in his postscript in the book. But because this book was written for his wife originally, that he wanted them to be able to be together. And that's why, you know, after Yumi, you know, is able to defeat the father machine or whatever there at the end, Painter is able to tether her cognitive shadow back to the physical world with his painting and these sorts of things, and more or less is able to bring her back. I wish he didn't. I think the story would have been more powerful if truly they didn't get to reconnect, you know, like, because neither of them got to talk after she kind of got sent back to her little world, and then she was able to figure out what she needed to do on her end, and he was able to figure out what he needed to do on his end in the Sandra Lanch ending there. And I think it's kind of like a fake out death and undermines a little bit of that, but I can understand wanting a happy ending, especially when he's writing a love story for his wife. So I can't fault it, but I think the story would have maybe been more powerful if Yumi hadn't come back.
I'm pretty much in the same boat as you. I remember reading the Sandra Lanch going, is he actually going to keep them apart? Is she not going to come back? And then she did. And I was like, oh, nope, we're going for all smile, happy endings. And I was kind of disappointed about that, even while it was like, oh, yes, I still get the warm fuzzies that the two young people get together. But it's like, sometimes I like those bittersweet, unhappy endings.
Yeah. So are you cold and heartless as well, Mark, or did you like it?
It's going to be very similar to what I said about my thoughts on the book, as I think I liked it. I share some of the same exact opinions in that I think the story would have been stronger if they stayed apart. But I think I enjoyed the happy ending. Not to get meta about it, but I feel like the world is just so kind of like complicated. I'll just say that, you know. Mm-hmm. And we've certainly, I think, our shows and our books and our movies, I think we have done a good job of like covering, like, no, there's not always a happy ending. But to some extent, sometimes maybe too much. Not saying that this would have been one of them. I think this would have been a great story to have like a bittersweet ending. But I think in a world where a lot of our shows are meant to shock us into like depression or whatever, I was like, okay, I'm happy with a nice, clean, and they live happily ever after kind of story. But I think it might have been the epilogue where she came back, if I'm not mistaken. Correct. I don't know. So I'm also kind of okay with that if you technically, it's like a post-credit scene, so that like if you were to close the book before reading the epilogue, it's great, and then you read the epilogue and you get like a little bonus. I know no one reads books like that, and we always read the epilogue. But
right, yeah, and I think that's fair. I think that's a good take too, because that's a huge part of the reason that I like Sanderson so much, is that I'm kind of a sucker for the like good guys are good, bad guys are bad. You know what I mean? Like the good guys usually do heroic and great things and win. Like I know it's tropey and a little bit, you know, and that's not all Sanderson, obviously. He's got some other stuff mixed in there too, but like, I don't know. I like that I get like good, warm, fuzzy, happy feelings when I'm reading most of these books. Most of the time it's the reason that like Parks and Rec and Good Place and stuff are my favorite TV shows, because like you get like those good feelings. So maybe I'm being a little bit of a hypocrite and wishing that this one had a different ending, but yeah, it works. I think it would have worked both ways probably. And who knows? We've gotten word of Sanderson afterward that Yumi is like more invested than the average Elantrin, and like one of the single I think more invested than most of the heralds, in fact. So like she's one of the most invested non-shards in the entire Cosmere. So who knows, maybe this little backwater noodle shop will have a role to play in the Mistborn space age as well.
That would be cool.
And I hope it doesn't actually.
You hope it doesn't? I have a hard time believing that she would be anything more than like a bit player. Like I like when Shai showed up in Lost Metal. Like, I think that would be too big of a role even for Yumi to pop up in a later one, but maybe a little.
I can understand. Like, she seems a little too powerful if she's the most invested being in the Cosmere. I don't know. It seemed like such a nice little self-contained corner where they've got their own alien planet that they can partner up with. There's like nothing else to do with anywhere else in the Cosmere. Kind of like, yeah, you know, we're gonna get the space age, they'll probably end up everywhere at some point, but kind of like the idea that, you know, it makes it still feel big if there's little quarters that even Scadrial and Roshar can't get to.
That's fair. I think the connection piece is probably not going to be with their planet, but with Utol, the planet. So that's that star that they spent about half the book, you know, talking about the spaceship going to, which I liked that twist because I was fully convinced that they were both on these planets and that there was going to be some sort of bridge between the two of them. So I did like the twist that they were actually pretty geographically close to each other. Because that one got me for sure.
It got me a good bit as well. And I kept thinking, it's like, it seems so obvious, but you know, sometimes the obvious thing does end up working out. So it's like, I'm going to keep going along with their working theory and we'll see if it gets twisted. And then I actually did. And it was kind of one of the odd things about it was like, it got sidelined so much too. Like we heard mentions of it, but they weren't like, they're like, oh, well, it'll happen and we'll find out. And so they just took that wait and see approach and it didn't feel very like a very active part of the story, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, because they were just waiting to see. And then, yeah, once they realized it's like a water planet with four-armed fey life on it, it was like, oh, well, never mind. I guess not. And they never thought about it again, so we didn't get much more of it in the narrative there.
And that probably should have been our big red flag to be like, they're not really doing much with this. Like, they're so passive. So, like, they're not even closely tracking when exactly it's going to happen. Like, they're not trying to get closer to it or anything. It's like, oh, well. Mm-hmm. Just didn't take those clues.
Yeah. I think the big takeaways from that, other than the twist there, would be that that's almost certainly the planet that Nomad jumps to at the end of Sunlit. Because he lands on a water planet with Shodel. So there will be some connectivity there with that one. And there's a non-zero chance that I'm going to forget the name of the Chondra that Harmony sent off at the end of the final Era 2 Mistborn book. But the epilogue there, one of the Chondra shows up and is found after going through the perpendicularity with a boat with a bunch of Shodel on it as well. So there's potentially two other books that recently came out that have a character end up on that same planet. So who knows? Maybe it has some role to play in future books, which means that due to the proximity, Yumi's planet might as well.
Wasn't it Maylin? Was the one that got sent off?
Thank you. Yeah, it's been very long. Well, not very long time, but yeah, what, year and a half now? 2 years?
You're picking up on more than I am, so I didn't even remember Nomad ending up on a water planet, so, or that there are more people on a water planet from various other sources, so.
Yeah, I think reading the forums helped me with that one, because yeah, I probably wouldn't have remembered had I not seen other people talking about that. So any other general thoughts from either of you on the book? Any other, maybe a part you really did or really didn't like in the books?
I guess one thing I wanted to talk a bit about was the magic systems.
Okay.
That's usually one of the big draws for me with Brandon Sanderson. And this one, I felt like part of the reason why I didn't like it as much is a lot of it was de-emphasized, right? Some of it was comparative to just be like, oh, here it is, how it is in each world. But like the Heon lines, for all intents and purposes, basically worked as a combination of neon lights and electricity.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there was some small variations with like the viewers could only use those two colors to make images. But essentially, Painter's World is kind of the shortcut to be like, oh, well, you don't have to learn two magic systems. Like, yes, there's a little bit of a twist here, but you could think of it like electricity. You could think of it like neon lights, because that's how they use it.
Right.
And then, like, Yumi's part of the world. It was all based on the spirits turning into things. And I feel like that's Brandon's attempt at a soft magic system. To kind of hand wave and be like, oh, the spirits have, you know, enough power. They're fully invested. They draw their power directly from the spiritual realm. Like, they can basically do what they want with that power. energy to matter. So.
Yeah, you know. they definitely, especially because there was nobody really there to explain to us, they definitely felt much more soft magic than a lot of his other stuff. Like, for folks that have read a lot of Cosmere, like, you can kind of get it a little bit by just comparing them to, like, Spren or, like, Seons or Skaze or any of these other, like, splinters sort of things, because they're going to be very similar in how they work. Right. But yeah, we didn't get a great picture of the rules for how they work, other than sometimes they can fly or sometimes they can make light or, you know.
Or
apparently they really like watching soap operas, is what we found out at the end.
Or they have some common devices and things that they know really well. And so if the intent and the image and everything don't line up very well, the things that the spirits are made into may not work as intended or may not last as long. So yeah, that's like you said, that's kind of one of those things where prior knowledge from reading lots of other Sanderson books helps to fill in those gaps since no one's really diving into it. And also it's kind of something I've noticed with this one, along with some of the other more recent Cosmere stuff, is the growing importance or greater understanding of the people in the books about intent. Intent was big at Warbreaker for Awakening, but we didn't really see it again in any other books until later Stormlight. And this one in particular, too, with, like, you know, Yumi has to give the spirits her intent for what they should do. The stronger that intent is how successful the transformation is.
Yeah, and not only intent, but, like, I think that, especially in the Secret Projects and some of his other recent works, we've gotten a lot more with identity as well, and a lot more with connection. And I mean, I'm sure connection will be like the big thing we talk about in Sunlit, but I think where the magic did work for me, and one thing that I did like, especially coming from other Cosmere works, was with the painting. I think being able to see that, you know, kind of the way that Painter was able to ultimately beat, or at least stave off, the nightmares for long enough for Yumi to beat Father Machine, was by painting them as what their identity was, you know, as these town people, that as they were before the shroud started turning them into nightmares, which I think was kind of a cool nod and made a ton of Cosmere related sense as to, and especially with the background that we got about, like, well, bamboo kind of works sometimes because you can kind of pretend that the thing looks like bamboo, especially when it doesn't have a lot of forms. But once they were these, like, fully fledged nightmares, he had to paint them as they actually were to get them to shut down, which I think, I'm not sure how well that worked for somebody that is going into this book without a lot of Cosmere knowledge, but coming into it with a lot, it did feel like a satisfying way for them to actually beat those nightmares for me.
I guess since I haven't gotten back to the later half of the book, my reread, a lot of that I've already kind of forgotten or buried, because a lot, like I said, I checked out a bit once I was like, oh, this is Final Fantasy.
Yeah.
So a lot of the Sanderlanch was not that impactful for me. It's like, okay,
fair.
Like, oh, he's finally doing what they told him to do, try and paint them how they look, or how he, you know, knowing how they were in the other world, how they should look.
I do think, like, it is probably one of the weaker Sanderlanches, though. I mean, like, I just said, like, I love the book, and it was my favorite of the projects, but we are used to, like, these big moments, and it's still a cool moment. I don't think it's, like, a bad climax, but, like, with all the other things that we're used to, with how he, like, wraps up the story, it does feel off, I think.
Well,
it does. And that's my biggest gripe with the book. And I think viewing it through the lens of being like a romance novel more than like an action novel, I can forgive it for not having a great, or not great, but not as big of like an action set piece to end it. My big problem was that none of the characters actually learned any of the reasons that these things were happening, really. We got like a third person Hoid explaining it to the audience narrative about what happened on this planet right before the Sanderlach happened, because the characters themselves and we as the readers literally didn't learn any of this. Like, we knew that there was a machine, and then we found out kind of that, like, right before Hoid started explaining things, that Yumi had been doing this for 1100 or 1700 years or whatever it was. But then they literally took us out of the narrative for Hoid to give us, as the audience, like a multiple page long backstory of the world before taking us back into what the characters were doing. And I kind of just hated that. Like I wish that he had been able to work that in. I don't know how he would have. Like, I guess it would have needed to be like one of her handlers going rogue somehow and explaining it to her. But like, when we think of these other like Cosmere mysteries, Brandon really says he likes for the reader to be able to figure out what happened right before the characters do. That's when he says he thinks he did the best job with his twists and his things. And like, there's no way we could have figured out the twist before the characters did, like, because nobody knew what was going on. They didn't tell us. They gave us nothing and then info dumped the Father Machine on us, basically, right before they started fighting Father Machine. So that was my big gripe with how the book ended.
I wonder if like the framing of Hoid narrating, because I'm thinking when you were saying that, like, well, like, I don't know how you easily solve it, because then if like one of her attendees like said, like, someone's just going to info dump, I guess, because we're not going to be able to see it. And I feel like if maybe they were POV chapters written in from their perspective, like, maybe Yumi could have received, like, and this is a cliche, but it's a little better, like, if she just got like glimpses of what had happened and it's up for us to determine. I don't know. It is weird, because you would, I mean, that's right when everything's about to happen. And I guess even if you were to like accurately or smoothly explain it, it would be like a weird pacing moment too, because you're like ready to get into like the action and we're going to say, okay, let's pause and tell you real quick. Yeah, I don't know. It's an awkward moment for sure. The Hoid version's at least a quick, it's like a Band-Aid. It's a quick like, okay, we're going to explain it and then we're going to like go back to the action.
yeah, exactly. It was quick. That is fair. And yeah, I don't know how you solve it. And obviously he didn't either, because that's how he chose to do it. It's not the worst thing in the world, but I the one thing that I think I put in the show notes there, but like where I compared it to, was the realization that that humans were the Void Bringers in Oathbringer was kind of like a similar, like, we'd gotten breadcrumbs and you could have maybe kind of thought this before it happened, but then all the characters found out at the same time that we did. And it had like these big ramifications, and we kind of understand some of the fused issues and how this is all working for them now. Mm-hmm. And here, like, it was all kind of soulless antagonists that were basically just these, you know, cognitive shadows being controlled by a machine. So I don't know, the bad guys and their backstory just being brought up the way it did just didn't really work for me.
And I guess tying it back to what we were saying earlier about pacing and this being a mystery, one of the things that struck me a lot rereading the first half is that, you know, Painter worries about the nightmare and he goes out to investigate, but we never follow him as he investigates, right? We get Yumi's perspective. He's out doing something else. And, you know, she's getting acclimated or trying to think of what they should do. But like, we get that introduction early on with the nightmare, then they start swapping places and there's this long stretch of nothing happening with the nightmare. And, you know, it's like, I don't really get that mystery sense on that front. Like, what is the nightmare doing until you start getting into the later half and they actually start having things happen with the nightmare in Painter's part of the world again? And maybe that's where, if this was a, you know, more bigger Brandon epic, we had the interlude chapters with people in the past or his handmaidens to kind of fill in the blanks. You could put in more interspersal things where it's like, okay, now we're in the Painter stretch of things. Like, he could go investigate for a while and Yumi can get acclimated to the world, do her shopping trip, get clothes and all that. And plus, like, some of the time jumpiness things of it, where he's out for like 10, 12 hours and, you know, he gets written up and stuff, but, or he goes, gets put on medical leave, which is a very convenient. They have an automatic process for putting him on 30 day medical leave. It's kind of, it's like, you know, it's like, here in America, you don't show up to work, you'd be immediately fired.
Right.
Like, there's just no ifs, ands, or buts about it, usually, unless your boss is really nice, and this boss is not nice to him.
Yeah, so, I like your take on the, like, if it was a bigger book. I don't know that the book as a whole would work bigger that way, but, like, I'm just picturing now that maybe we had interlude chapters of another one of these Yoki Hojo, whatever Yumi is, yeah. Whatever they're called.
Yokohedro.
Thank you. Yep. As a non-audiobook listener, those pronunciations always kill me. Where we're seeing them experiencing kind of similar things with a machine showing up and all these sorts of things. But then we maybe find out in their last interlude chapter that we were actually following that person 1700 years ago and watch Father Machine turn on and kill everybody. It kind of got to see it through that lens, almost like a Westworld-y season one, sort of like you're following this person along, thinking it's just another one of these people in the same time, but you are actually watching a long time ago. Spoilers for Westworld, I guess. sort of thing probably could have worked, but that then becomes a very different book if we're including interludes and
POV
character and all that sort of stuff.
Well, yeah, you would have had to intersperse more stuff with the nightmare leading up to it, right? You'd have to have a little more of the tension building to be like Painter having more confrontations and find out the bamboo maybe isn't working. Have ramp up more that, oh, he needs to get back on board with actually painting things.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. They could have really helped basing some more of that stuff in elsewhere. Instead, we've got a long, very exposition-y, we're gonna do the same things that we normally do in our own worlds, just have you do them, which it's like, I don't know, this kind of stuck with that plan way too long, in my opinion. Like, you guys should have been trying to shake things up sooner, I think, especially with this short of a book, keep things moving along.
Yeah, fair. So Mark, since you've got some notes written on it, do you think this book is a good, like, standalone or introduction into the Cosmere? Because Brandon has said that he believes that this one and Tress are both, like, really good jumping in points for somebody who is maybe interested but isn't wanting to get, like, super invested into having to read all 20 books or however many there are now. What are your thoughts on that?
I think it would be. Matt, hearing you talk about the magic system, I guess the only, like, caveat I would have is I think if you're going into it expecting, like, if you enjoy hard magic systems, this might be a struggle, because if you, like, have this idea about what Brandon's about and it's a soft magic system and you're trying to maybe figure out what's going on, you might, you know, you're kind of be going, fighting an uphill battle there. But otherwise, I think it's fine. I do, for the time being, I think most Cosmere books are still good introductions, because if I know we're in a world where, like, we're in, like, Marvel fatigue, but I remember when I first started reading Stormlight, I don't know how I missed the memo that the books were connected in even vague ways.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember when what is Vasher's name in Stormlight?
Zahel.
Yeah. And he started, like, saying these, like, you know, these, I forget, he would, like, say things that were, like, little slang terms in his word, and he's like, oh god, sorry, he's like, you don't know what I'm saying. And I remember reading it, not knowing anything, going, I don't know why this is happening, but, like, he's definitely, like, from another dimension or a time or something that's just wild, and I want to know more about him. So I think, like, what's nice about this is you could get a little bit of that if you hear about a shard and other systems in the Cosmere with Yumi, A, you're not committed to like a 5,000-page series. And if there are things that you like, you know, with the internet, you could be like, oh, how do I learn more about this? What is Awakening? Oh, go read Warbreaker. So, yeah. And then I did write down here, I can't remember how they handled Awakening, but I guess, like, since that is sort of pivotal to the plot, not having... I can't remember if that is well explained or if that is really required knowledge. So that's the only thing that I feel like is kind of, like, the sticky point.
It's not explained very well, which I think is good in the sake of this book, because who knows how the spirits and magic on this world would work with that. Like, it's pretty vague. Hoyd kind of gives a cheeky Nightblood sort of reference about, you know, the dangers of not fully understanding the command that you're giving when awakening something. But that's about it. Like, we kind of get the vague impression that they used magic to turn something that wasn't alive into something that had sentience, and that's all we get.
And I guess that's like an okay, like, sci-fi trope. You know, that happens with like robots and AI and
absolutely
other universes where they like give, they create the robot with a goal in mind and then it reinterprets what that means. So yeah, I guess that's fine.
How about you, Matt? What do you think about this one as a standalone or introduction to the Cosmere?
Well, I'm going to dive way back into my college days here when some friends and I started reading The Wheel of Time, and a lot of my friends dropped off of it because it was too slow.
Sure.
And I have to keep thinking about this one going, I think this book is slow. And I don't think The Wheel of Time is slow, or I don't worry about that criticism of it. So I don't think it is.
Yeah, and that's...
I think it's a lot to get into, and it just doesn't develop very quickly, and I think a lot of people would just go, if you're not interested in the initial premise of, like, the body swapping and, you know, the world building, then, you know, nothing else is going to pull you in, keep you reading. At least not for half the book.
Yeah.
Yeah, I guess it's like a Cosmere thing. It's fine, because if you enjoy some of the things that they hint at, go look it up and go read those relevant books. But I guess to your point, if you're like, oh, I hear Stormlight is great, I want to start with this novella and it's a body swap romance, you're going to be like, wait, I thought there's like giant swords. Yeah, it is very niche. And right now there's not a lot for you to dive into if you want more of that. Not to backpedal my own opinion.
And that's kind of where I am hesitant to think it's a great introduction, not even less so on the pacing, but more so on how different it is from the rest of his works. Like, I think, Mark, you said you liked the romance piece in this one and thought it was done pretty well. I tend to agree. I thought it was cute, and he did a pretty good job with it. And that's as somebody who thinks that, like, some of his other ones that he's done, like Vin and Elend and in Warbreaker, were just not great. So he's grown as an author in that regard, but
agreed.
I don't know that it gives a super good representation of, like, I don't know if you read this book and really like it, if that means you're going to like the rest of Cosmere novels, or the vice versa. Like, if you read this and really don't like it, that means you're not going to like the rest of Sanderson, would be kind of my big hesitancy. Like, I think Tress, I said I had issues with the ending as an introduction to people because I think it could feel a little bit out of left field how Hoyd has, like, there's a spaceship with an Elantrian and a map on the floor and all these sorts of things. Like, if you don't know what's going on, you could be confused. But the rest of Tress is very Sanderson. Like, you get a taste of who he is and the things he writes and his magic and how he does it and these sorts of things. So I think it's a good introduction to him in that regard, where this one doesn't feel as Sanderson-y.
I actually don't know. I guess I'm going to completely walk back my take, because I don't know what I'd recommend to you. Like, if I met, like, another me and they're like, I love this book, it was like, ignoring the secret projects, I don't know where I'd send you next. Because, like you said, some of the romances aren't as strong, so I wouldn't feel confident being like, oh, well, go read Warbreaker. Yeah, I don't know actually where you would go from here. Other than, like, you would say, like, what, go read Arcanum Unbound, maybe? Because there's, like, just some other short story. I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. I mean, I guess you'd have to just send them on the path of reading Mistborn 1 or something like that at this point and be like, it's going to be very different, but...
Yeah, because yeah, you basically are like, okay, now that you liked this, are you into steampunk or are you into, I don't even know what kind of fantasy you call Stormlight, but epic fantasy, I'll just say. And that's not what either, that's not what this book is at all. It's neither of those.
Yeah, interesting stuff there. So
probably Tress would be the next lead-in from Yumi, right? Because it's also
probably
the next most romancy of the stories. Like, okay, if you like this, go read Tress. That'll be more like what the rest of the Brandis Anderson stuff is. If you like that, then go to Mistborn.
Yeah, exactly. And I would probably just flip-flop them and say read Tress first then, I guess, and then you can go do whatever you want. So we're getting towards the end here of our time that we have to record tonight, so I want to make sure we get a couple of these things in here, because one of them is my favorite. but this book was not super Cosmere connected, definitely less so than Sunlit, which is like crazy amounts of Cosmere connectivity, but this one I think there are some interesting and fun bits in there. And since I got to the spreadsheet first and have mine typed in, I'm gonna do mine here first as my favorite like greater connection to the Cosmere, and that was that we found out that Virtuosity was the shard here. She got name dropped. And that she splintered herself, which, wasn't killed by Odium. Like, maybe, I think, kind of was, would maybe be originally led to believe by a shard being dead, but did it herself. And there's a really interesting theory that I've seen on 17th Shard and the Cosmere subreddit that because she was maybe not necessarily bound to that system, but at least could not interact and get experiences in systems that other shards did, intentionally splinter themselves to create the Irriale people who have the very, very yellow hair. And, you know, we got the high on lines are missing yellow to be the cyan pink yellow that we see in printers and, you know, ink and color and that sort of thing. Everybody was wondering if we were going to need a yellow high on line at some point. So the yellow hair of these people, they're traveling around to a bunch of different planets, getting a bunch of different experiences. We've seen them a ton in, you know, they got a Stormlight 5 interlude where they are featured now that's been released. They've got, they showed up in Lost Metal. They showed up in Tress. So that's my favorite theory, is that Virtuosity intentionally shattered themselves to let these people travel around the Cosmere and gain experiences. And they have a religion called the One, where they're trying to recreate the One, where I think the idea that Brandon's trying to trick us with is that they're trying to reform Adonalsium, but I think they're actually trying to reform Virtuosity. So I love that theory. It's my favorite Cosmere theory now. That's the one that I'm championing moving forward, that this book kind of, with us finding out that Virtuosity was shattered herself for some reason, being kind of the big sticking point that we got from this book that really drives that theory home.
Those are a lot of excellent points. I'm fully on board with this theory.
Yeah, I could never have come up with this by myself. I can take zero credit for making this theory. This is 100% something that I read and was like, yes, I love that. So yeah, this is not from my mind at all.
I guess this is where
I agree.
I guess this is where having dropped off reading the forums a lot, I'm disconnected from the theory crafting. I've gotten to the point where I'm like, I'm just gonna wait and read and find out.
Yeah, and you know, I think that's probably the better way to do it, because then you get to be surprised instead of being either. You know, like when we talk about the Shallan thing earlier, like either, like I have one of two things now where either I am going to be like, oh yeah, we saw that coming, or, oh, I'm kind of disappointed that that didn't happen. Whereas I think if you weren't thinking about that, you could maybe just have like an honest reaction to what actually does happen, as opposed to comparing it against what you've got built up in your mind about what might happen. Oh, let's see. Either of you have any big Cosmere things that you liked or saw or thought about as a result of this one?
Matt, I'll let you go with it, because I don't have much to add here other than I just like the idea of a shard split, shattering themselves. And I would love to just get insight into that one day. doubt we ever would, but I just thought that was fascinating.
Yeah, it seems very against Shardic intent to destroy themselves. So, who knows?
With virtuosity, maybe because of the Shard holders have broken up, Alnicea, maybe lingering guilt may have played a part in that decision.
Yeah.
I don't know. I like that we got another set of people who came up with space travel, essentially, and, you know, went to another planet, even if it's not Skadriel, Roshar.
Mm-hmm.
We got, you know, a new set of people who are not so close to human either. You know, we got four-armed people. I don't remember the name. Like I said, that part of the book just felt so passive. Even if it was supposed to mainly distract us from where Yumi might really be.
Yeah.
And I mean, I was paying attention a lot to the magic systems, trying to figure things out. And, you know, yeah, the spirits do feel a lot like Aeons and Spren. And they seem to like people a lot, even so much that they just became Heon lines for them. Mm-hmm. And continued to even be Heon lines after the shroud was lifted. I don't know. I probably spent more time thinking about, like, especially after reading the book, what the ecological disaster of the shroud happening the first time around, and then it being lifted after. Like, the people somehow adapted to perpetual night. They would have had to survive, but, you know, what the landscape must look like around the cities and stuff that didn't have Heon lines. There must be, like, virtually no plant or animal life left. And we saw a little bit of it, Yumi. It wasn't exactly a verdant paradise with the super hot ground and there were plants and birds, so I don't know.
Yeah, there's a second epilogue where Hoid kind of talks about it and was like, yeah, they found seeds or something like that near the father machine of old plant life that used to grow on the planet and planted them and things worked.
But which still, is
not super satisfying, but.
Yeah, I mean, it's hand wavy, but at the same time, it's, you know, talk about Marvel again. You know, one of the online reactions about half the life being wiped out in an instant by Thanos. Like, you just lost half the bees. We have ecological collapse within like a year.
Right.
So, I don't know. It's one of those things where it's like, yeah, I don't know. Like, yeah, they have, you know, they could have plants, but I don't know that they have any animals left on that planet after the shroud, and much even more so after the shroud is gone again.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's fair.
Sorry, I'm derailed from favorite Cosmere things. I guess I don't think about it too much as a, you know, since it is not super Cosmere connected, I haven't thought about it too much other than just being excited. It was, oh, yes, we have magical technology. Oh, it's mostly electricity. Or maybe there will be some things later that's some more variants.
Maybe we'll be able to turn a spirit into a spaceship. I don't know. You really want to be a faster than light space drive. I'm sure of it.
Yeah.
Well,
I guess they had to ride their spaceship on the Heon lines, which is interesting.
Yeah.
It's like, I guess they're just light. I mean, and they're spirits, like, you know, they could be infinitely elastic for all we know. They could have infinite length if they wanted to. There's nothing stopping them from creating interstellar Heon lines, I guess.
Yeah, that's fair. Yeah, it's always fun to get, like, we don't know enough about this magic system to be as excited about, you know, all of, like, the weird time bubbles and stuff that people have theorized that, like, Skadriel could do to make faster-than-light technology. But always fun to kind of see where Brandon's trying to cook up how to turn his magic into sci-fi, which is neat.
We talked before, like, do we think we'll see Yumi again in later books or anything else? And it's like, well, this one's so disconnected from everything else to begin with. It's kind of its own isolated corner. Like, I don't know that we'll ever get there, especially with Brandon really trying to focus on things that he's been wanting to write forever, basically. Fill out the Cosmere. We got these four secret projects, and it was so surprising to get a fifth one without the pandemic and everything else. Granted, he doesn't travel like he used to, book tours. So maybe he squeezed in more time there.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't watched the video yet and how he got time to write a project yet.
No, me either. Mark, how about you? Any Cosmere connection things you like?
The last one that I wrote, and this is where my like knowledge of everything gets a little hazy, but just if there's any connection between the Shroud and the Shades on Threnody, or even the Midnight Essence, I would just be curious like what laws of physics, quote unquote, are in place, because there's certainly something happening with like black, ethereal, smoky objects in the Cosmere now, and I'm looking forward to like, are they connected, and if they're not, just like what causes it. Anything with the Threnodice has me interested, and I immediately thought of the Shades.
Yeah, I mean, there are too many things that are too similar to each other now for them not to have some level of like connectivity between themselves. I agree. Like, even if it's not the exact same as the Shades and Midnight Essence, there's a similar rule that Brandon has created in the Cosmere that creates these weird dark smoke monsters in some
capacity. Could be identity related too, because it's late. I'm also because identity is a big thing with the Shades too, correct?
Correct.
Yeah.
It could even just be a case of, oh, the shards are copying from each other. Someone came up with something neat, and they're like, hey, I like that. Let me try to do something similar.
Yeah, maybe. My last one's pretty minor, and that's that we see design not on Roshar. And like that's been a big problem. You know, we have no idea how to get Spren or Investiture off of Roshar as of where we're at in Stormlight 4. And they kind of played it a little coy in Tress, where maybe design was the thing that they were hiding in the like cabinet, because they talked about like, you wouldn't believe me if I told you what was in that drawer or whatever that was kind of making noise and moving around. People speculated that it might have been design hiding in there, but she's just like front and center here. So it's always interesting to get an answer to what seems like a big question from another series as kind of just like a, oh yeah, no, it's not actually a problem. See, look, like Hoid got off world and was totally fine in Mistborn, which we know happens after Stormlight 5. And now we see that design is off world here, which is obviously after Stormlight 10 or after Stormlight 5 as well. So like, it's weird getting to see these answers to these questions getting answered way before I think we thought we would. Because I would have guessed that at best we would have gotten the answer to this question in Stormlight 5. About whether we can actually get Spren off world or how to do it.
I feel like where it's going to lie is probably the how. Or maybe that won't be interesting, I guess. But like, if there's say like a huge trade off to getting someone like design off world, you know, kind of like how, I guess this doesn't involve the creation of the shard blades, but like, you know, the shard blades, when you find out like, you know, how everyone has a shard blade, like what a shard blade actually is pretty sad, as far as the ones that aren't Knights Radiant. And maybe if there's something to getting Spren off Roshar, that is like a big cost that can make it interesting, because we don't know how, right? We just know it's possible.
Correct.
Yeah,
exactly. So yeah, who knows, maybe it's difficult, maybe something bad happened, but we know it's possible now at the very least. I mean, it made sense that it was probably always going to be possible, but interesting, yeah, to see it happen in the future.
Since they can cross over, or at least live in the cognitive realm so easily, I don't know. I kind of accepted it was going to be a foregone conclusion. They were going to figure it out, since it Investiture powers pretty much everything in the Cosmere. Like, getting a easily accessible source of it is going to be key to magical technology peripherating through the Cosmere.
Mm-hmm.
It was just a matter of, okay, what's the how and why of it?
Yeah, that's fair. And I guess we haven't seen if they've managed to get Stormlight off-world yet, which is like the really big thing that the Ghostbloods are working towards. So there's still that mystery floating there as well.
Quick narrative-related thing, since while we are sort of on the topic of design, I do want to say I do, minus how I don't like how design is described and how she came about that appearance, I did like her character a lot and how to the character, I think this is a good way of explaining for those who like know Cosmere stuff. So like to the reader, a lot of things design says, you're like, oh, I get it. You know, because she talks about Investiture in a way that we would understand, but the characters are like, oh, this woman is just not right in the head. I thought that was a really clever way to do it, and I really enjoyed it. And I can't remember the line, but Hoid talks about how when design, I guess, realized that Hoid was going to stay frozen as a coat hanger, that she like spray painted him or something. Mm-hmm. And he says something like he would scream if he could, but he wasn't. Like the way Hoid described like that scene, I just like actually like laughed out loud while reading. And I do hope we get to maybe see more of like these two as like person to person interacting, not necessarily her like as a spren. So anyway, I just thought she was cool. I'm interested to see more of her.
Yeah, I liked that design was the person that they were interacting with instead of Hoid as a I think that was a fun twist on having a Cosmere aware character. That and then the Sleepless that they got to talk to at the end was a nice change of pace, I think. Sleepless.
I forgot about them.
Oh yeah, they're everywhere now. There's little crabs walking around making maps and stuff everywhere.
That one worked out too, right? Because isn't that the, like, to just pull stereotypes, that was kind of like the creepy goth girl in the group.
Correct.
Right. Yeah, and then it's like, oh, you would be the one who's actually, like, millions of bugs walking around as a person.
Yep. Yeah, exactly. Oh, good stuff.
Yeah. I enjoyed the interactions with design as well. Just as, like, I'm very glad that when they was listed the audiobook and they described how it looked, my wife was not in the car with me at the time. I really don't need to have this conversation again about some of Brandon's description.
I think with that one, I mostly have the problem that like Hoid did it too. Mm-hmm. So there was like intention. Now, this is not to give credit like in the long run, but like, you know, is that like a negative quality of Hoid we should be aware of? I don't know, but I just didn't like it, especially that he was involved in it.
Right, especially because Sanderson's usually pretty good about like good representation and not steering into like harmful tropes and stereotypes. You know, especially, you know, we talk about like mental illness and like GLBT or LGBTQ representation and all these sorts of things as he's trying to work them into his book. So it was a little jarring to see like kind of the male gazey sort of descriptions. I think Akane, whatever her name is as well. Mm-hmm. Kind of got the same treatment, and even Yumi from time to time. So yeah, that would be a disappointment from the book for sure. Perfect, but I think we are pretty much up at the recording time that we have here tonight. Was there anything else, any parting shots that you two didn't get to bring up that you really wanted to say regarding the book before we sign out?
I can't think of anything. Go for it, Matt.
I was just going to reiterate, I don't hate this. I enjoyed reading it the first time through.
Yeah.
The second time through, I'm still not hating it, but I started rereading or re-listening to the audiobook a couple months ago and been taking long breaks in between. So
I was gonna say, it's not that long of a book.
Yeah. It's like, I think that's just kind of where I'm at with it is like, don't see much reason to reread this one. Like I do a lot of the other one. I think it's going to take a lot to get me back to this one where like someone would from this book would have to show up again to be like, oh, do I want to know more about them? I think it's still worth at least a read.
Yeah. Yeah. Agreed. Perfect.
Well, I guess Oh, I was going to say, the only thing I'll add is I look forward to our next episode, because I feel like, Matt, you and I are going to be doing like a little dance, because not to tease things, but I feel like we're going to like flip-flop again, and it'll be interesting to discuss.
Perfect. That's a great teaser for Sunlit Man, because let's not wait like 8 months or 9 months or however long it's been since we got together to discuss that one, because I think I'm very excited about the Cosmere implications there, and then excited to hear the maybe differing views between the three of us on the quality of that book as well. So thanks for those of you that stuck around here to the end of this one, and we'll be back again with episode 4 of Shardboard to talk the last secret project, Sunlit Man, here at some point on the Acast feed. So thanks for listening, and thank you too for joining me here tonight.